Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, January 6th, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me today are the usual suspects, my brother Bob Novella.
Hello, everyone.
Perry DeAngelis.
Happy New Year.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Happy New Year, everyone. This is our first episode for the 2006 year. And I'm going to get right to our guest on this episode. We are starting the year out with a fabulous guest, James Randi. James Randi is a renowned skeptical investigator and educator. He began his career as a professional magician, performing under the name The Amazing Randi, and now runs the James Randi Educational Foundation, which you can visit their website at randi.org. The JREF, as we call it, administers the famous $1 Million Psychic Challenge, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Randi is known as the scourge of hucksters, con artists, charlatans, and quacks everywhere, as he delights in exposing their lies and deceptions. Lectures extensively on critical thinking, on skepticism, and exposing fraud, the author of numerous books, including The Mask of Nostradamus and Flim Flam. Randi, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Welcome, Randi.
I doubt that.
Thanks for joining us. We appreciate you coming on.
Pleasure to be here for my first visit, and I think I should announce right off the top that starting early in February, we will be doing a podcast via our own website at www.randi.org. It's something I should have gotten into some time ago, frankly, Steve, and happy to be in on yours and going to start my own.
Excellent. Another skeptical podcast is always a good thing.
Randi, do you anticipate a weekly or monthly podcast?
Oh, it'll be weekly.
Weekly, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's going to be very popular.
Well, I hope so. We'll see.
Yeah, actually, we had been talking with, I believe, Linda and some of your people about having a one-stop shopping for a skeptical podcast, or at least mutual links, so people can go to one location and access all of the skeptical podcasts that are being made out there. There's only a few of them. I mean, there's Skepticality, there's our podcast, there's one in England, and yours would be the fourth that I know of. I don't know if you know of any others.
Not offhand.
No, I don't.
So why don't we start by talking about your favorite psychic, Sylvia Brown?
No, my favorite claimed psychic.
Claimed psychic. Brown. Yes. It's always implied, because there are no such things as psychics. So do you want to just give us the update? Tell us about Sylvia's fabulous performance on Coast to Coast the other night.
I haven't heard it yet. It's been sent to me in some form or another whereby I can listen to it, but I haven't done that yet. She so grates me, and her voice is so gravelly, to say the least. This is my imitation of Sylvia Brown.
Right.
And that's doing her credit. I haven't listened to it, but I have gotten enough excerpts from it, word for word, that it's pretty obvious she had a serious flub.
Right.
That's the only way you can describe it. And yet people have said to me, I was just speaking with, what was his name, Roger Friedman of...
Well, the Fox News did a report on it.
It's Fox News.
I have that article in front of me, actually.
Yeah. Well, he missed something in that article, obviously. He said that the challenge had never been accepted. Well, it's been accepted by hundreds of people.
Right.
And particularly by Sylvia Brown, with an E. Sylvia accepted that back in, was it 2001 or something? I forgot.
2001.
Yeah.
And it's been up on our webpage ever since, as you know. You can click on it. We've got a new clicker on our webpage this week, and it's to download the video, 50 seconds of it, from the Larry King show, show that she did back then on that date, in which she very distinctly accepts, yes, she will accept the challenge, and she will accept the test. And then, of course, her first excuses right off the bat, within the first month or so, where I don't know how to contact Randi.
Right.
Duh! I mean, let's face it, this is a psychic, and she doesn't even know how to use the phone book? I don't think so.
Now, you're really hard to track down, Randi. I mean,
yeah,
it's hard to get a hold of you.
Hard to find me. Google knows nothing about me, of course. But she finally gave up on that particular aspect, and she simply turned away all our mail, that is email and registered and certified mail, refused it all. We did get a delivery to her office, though, by a fellow who lives within sight of her office, and I better not specify anything more, or he'll be getting grenades through the window. He went over, actually disguised as a messenger, walked in and put an envelope down on the desk and then walked out. And apparently it, well, I would imagine it got to Sylvia, but it didn't have my name on the outside or any letterhead. It was just addressed to Sylvia Brown. So she heard about it. She knows very well about the challenge.
Right.
She's always known about it.
Now, yeah, I saw that clip on your website, and although she, you know, accepted the challenge because she had to, she was on the spot, she had a decidedly sour look on her face. She clearly was unhappy about being put on the spot about that. And I know, as you said, you know, before, con artists don't want to take this test. Only people who are the people who are self-deluded are the ones who take the test. Con artists know they can't pass the test.
Well, in a couple of cases, we have had some knowing fakes. Not with the $1 million challenge, but some years ago when it was only $1,000, I had them take me up on it, but they backed out very quickly because they found out something which rather disappointed them. I know what I'm talking about.
Right. Right. Uh-huh. That's right. You know what the tricks are. But let's get back to the recent flap of Sylvia Brown. So I have some of the transcript here. Basically, there was a recent incident where 13 miners were trapped in a coal mine explosion, and everyone was very anxiously waiting to see what the outcome of this would be. It didn't look very good. The news looked very grim. Late at night, or early morning actually, at the time when she happened to be on the Coast to Coast show, the news came out that most of the miners had been found alive, which was very, very, very shocking and surprising because nobody was expecting that.
That was just around midnight.
Right. And Perry was actually watching this live. You were caught up in that, weren't you, Perry?
Yes, I watched the whole thing.
And Brown, the news was given to Brown on the Coast to Coast show, and she responded that she knew that they were going to be found. That she knew that they were
awesome.
That they were alive. And then sometime after that, I think it was a couple hours in real time.
Was about quarter to three.
Two or three hours.
The news came out that it was all an error, that 12 of the 13 miners were in fact dead, and the 13th was in critical condition. And Brown was given that news, you know, on the show, and
how did she react?
She totally collapsed. What could she do? She just backtracked and fumbled and said, I don't think there's anybody alive. She says maybe one. You know, how crazy for them to report that they were alive when they weren't. So it was an utter open-faced failure on her part. Not the first time, but it was particularly poignant because of the really incredibly erroneous news report that had came out. Took her utterly by surprise.
Yeah, well, we refer to that, I think, Steve, as a fiasco, is it?
Fiasco, yeah, that's being generous, I think.
I've got to point out something, if I may, here.
Sure.
Sylvia said something to Nuri after the thing had been reversed.
Mm-hmm.
And as you just mentioned, she tried to feed them back exactly the same message that she had given them before, but turned around.
Right.
In other words, she knew that was the case. And she also said, well, I didn't say they were alive. Duh. I mean, any kind of excuse. But she also said something else which sort of got by everyone. She said, remember, I was on here with you. Now, what she's trying to imply by that is that since she was busy doing that radio program, she didn't have the means to look at CNN or any other news source and find out that it was exactly the opposite to what had been represented.
Right.
And what people don't recognize necessarily is that she was on the telephone with Nuri. She wasn't in the studio with them. She was on the telephone. So she had access, and she had people all around her who could
sure.
rush up to her with a piece of paper and stick it under her nose, of course. So that might have gotten by a lot of people. She had every means of finding out that she was wrong.
That's right. She could have been doing what we're doing right now, just sitting in front of a computer with pulling up websites and getting access to real-time news while we're talking on the show.
Sure.
But it didn't help her in this case, obviously, because the news was false. And it just led her to make that erroneous statement. But this is what we see all the time, is whenever there's a high-profile national case, whether it's, you know, Chandra Levy, a missing person, or whatever, the psychics never seem to predict these major unexpected events.
Never.
It's not strange.
Isn't that odd? So, but still, Sylvia Brown refuses to take the psychic challenge, and yet the day counter, I noticed, has turned into a week counter. I guess there were too many digits for the day counter.
Yeah, we couldn't keep up with it.
Maybe it could go to a year counter eventually at some point.
Or centuries, who knows?
I saw Sylvia on a Larry King episode just about 10 days ago with Von Prague and some psychic I wasn't familiar with. I believe her name was Char.
Char Margolis, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And one of the token skeptics really had it in for Sylvia because of the whole $1 million prize, and she came up with some lame excuse about how she really can't do it because other people that have tried to do it have had trouble and it's not fair and just all these lame excuses.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to say that.
Yeah, that's what they all say whenever we bring up Randy's challenge to any sort of paranormal kook. They simply say it's unfair and it's all nonsense.
Yeah, I have a couple comments about the $1 million prize. I just, like you guys, I just, the $1 million prize I think is such a great feather in the skeptic's cap, because what could these paranormalists say about this? You know, that why don't they just do this? I mean, there's not one greedy paranormalist in the country that won't take a trip down to Florida and try to win this money.
No, let's kill that rumor right there. You don't have to take a trip down to Florida. That's the point.
Okay.
We can have anybody who makes application for the prize, and this is 97% of them so far, have been tested right where they are. Very few people have come to Florida. The only people who have ever come to Florida, two women from Lithuania, as a matter of fact, who came all the way over. We insisted they don't, that we could have them tested there, and we had the people all set up for it, but they actually got on a plane and came over here, and of course they fell on their collective nose.
But
we have had people who live right here in Florida, a matter of an hour or so away, who have driven into the foundation here and have been tested.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't let that go by. Pardon me for interrupting.
That's okay. Bob misspoke. In fact, we've tested several applicants locally here in Connecticut for you.
And
so you have people regionally all over the place who could do the testing.
It's certainly not necessary for anyone to travel to Florida. We'll do it right where they happen to be.
Now, there's a couple misconceptions about the prize that I'd like you to talk about a little bit. I mean, a lot of people know about it, but there's still some people persist in believing, these problems with the prize, such as, does he really have the money? And also that it's inconvenient and a problem or troublesome for a real paranormalist. Could you kind of address those issues to, kind of assuage some of these feelings that people have about the money and the fact that it's a difficult process? You know, it's not fair, in essence, to the people with the real ability.
Well, rather than going through a lot of details on it, I'll say this. We have a FAQ section under the challenge on our webpage. If you click on the challenge there, you'll come to FAQs. That's all handled beautifully in there. Briefly, I'll get into it. The point, first of all, the big objection right off the bat is, no, there is no $1 million. Well, we get rid of that very easily. All anyone has to do is make a phone call, send an email, get on a fax, whatever means anything short of better than telepathy, I should say. They have to get on the line and get a hold of us and simply ask for a copy of the proof of it. And we send them a Goldman Sachs document. We refresh it every month because they send us monthly documents saying the total amount that's in that account. Now, we're only liable for $1 million of that. I think currently it's at $1.1 million or some such amount. We take the interest off the top of it every now and then. So the fact that the prize money is available cannot be argued. It's there. Not only that, it is actually titled, the name of the account is the James Randi Educational Foundation Prize Account. And it's specified that it can't be used for any purpose except to be awarded to a person who will pass the simple test.
Excellent. Very simple.
Now, other questions you had there, you were saying that it's difficult. Well, how do they know it's difficult if they don't know what the test is going to be? Right. Now, I frequently get calls from people or emails from people saying, how do you test these people? What a dumb question. That's like saying, how do you play the violin, in 20 words or less? It depends on what their claim is. As I've said so often, if you claim you can fly by flapping your arms, just step over to the window and we'll have this test done in a few seconds. Whoops, you lose. These are very easy tests to do. They're very direct. They're very simple. And we don't design the test. Now, that's very important that we
Absolutely.
Specify that. We do not design the test. We can assist in the design, the protocol design, of course. But, pardon me, I'm emotionally overcome here. What we do is we work with the claimant, the applicant, I should say, because they haven't become a claimant yet. We work with the applicant to devise a test that the applicant and ourselves will agree is a fair, proper, and definitive test. That's where the big rub is in this thing. Some people we've argued with, one fellow for 4.5 years, a PhD out of California, we argued with him for 4.5 years over how to establish a protocol. And he kept changing his mind all the time. So we will design one.
I mean, they're just grasping at straws, really. They're just trying to claim that the prize hasn't been won because it's unfair. But they really have nothing to back up that claim. That's just a way to dismiss what are the real implications of it.
Well, there's another thing going here, too. They also claim that the prize has already been won and that I've refused to award it. Now, many people have claimed this, but these are people we've never heard of before. When they give me their names, I look them up in our records. We haven't got any trace of them whatsoever. But this, again, is the only way most of these people have out. And in some European country, they can get away with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the local broadcasters will say, ah, now we know that you actually won the prize, but James Randi wouldn't pay off. Of course, they don't bother to contact me.
Well, that would be doing real journalism.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to have that happen.
They can't be bothered with that.
No.
So, talking about, infamous pseudo-psychics that are gun-shy now of the Randi Psychic Challenge, before Sylvia Brown, there was Uri Geller. Who's not, certainly not what he used to be, but I still see his name popping up all the time. There was recently he was on a radio show where somebody mentioned your challenge, and you talked about this, I think, 2 weeks ago on your online journal, Swift.
Oh, yeah.
And he promptly, insisted that the caller be cut off and says, I refuse to deal with all skeptics and cynics. You have lumping skepticism and cynicism together. Have you seen any recent run-ins with him, or is he a history?
More importantly than that, he said that he hasn't been doing spoon bending for 10 years. Duh! He does it every opportunity he gets because he doesn't have anything else.
That's all he could do, is a simple conjuring.
You know, that's like saying that Fred Astaire, gave up dancing. Yeah, right. What else did he do, Poetry? Juggling? I don't think so. No. This is ridiculous. He's a one-trick pony, this guy, and he bends spoons. That's what he does. He doesn't do anything else. He doesn't tap dance either.
Yeah, he's pathetic. I don't know if this is actually true, but he claimed to be earning, this is a few years ago, $1 million or more, being a dowsing consultant, basically telling companies where to drill for water or oil or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
yeah.
unfortunately believable that he could actually scam, companies out of money like that. It always galls me when con artists, rip people off for such huge sums.
Well, there's a more of a con to it than you folks may realize. That not only is the basic claim a con, but the claim about the claim is a con, because he said that he's been paid millions by these people. He hasn't. He was paid something like, I think, $30,000 by Xanax, was it, in Australia, I believe. I don't remember that whole history. He's got such a long and sordid history that it's hard to remember all the details. And they wanted their money back.
Oh.
So it's a phony fraud. It's not even a real fraud.
No, a fake fraud. That's the worst kind.
Right.
part of me thinks that, if these companies are just so naive enough to go in with that, I have, very little hard feelings for them.
Let's be a little kinder about that.
I know.
Xanax was not a company that was fooled by Geller. No. It was their CEO who independently, and they sued him for it afterwards, who independently decided to give the money to Geller. And he did that without the board approval, and that's why they turned on him, because it was an individual who was enamored of Geller.
That's right.
I see. Okay.
I mean, you can think of corporate entities as being, you know, large, anonymous things, but really, real people get hurt. People who have stock, people who, you know, have their retirement accounts in it, employees, you know. So even though it may be a big company that's being defrauded, you know, it's individual people still get hurt. Of course, we do. It's easier to get emotionally upset when it's, you know, a little old lady who gets screwed out of her retirement money. And that's always a little bit more easy to sympathize with. But I think wherever the con occurs, there's always an innocent victim somewhere who was harmed by it.
Yeah, oh yeah. And in fact, it adds to the whole public view of miracles and such, and it promotes it. So that's harm that's done right there.
That's right. That's sort of the indirect harm, is anything that promotes belief in the supernatural, anti-scientific modes of thinking, has a ripple effect of harm that may not be immediately apparent. Often, I think the most tangible place where that causes harm is in healthcare. I know you don't do many of the challenges don't involve direct health claims, but you have investigated medical scams before. I know that I think the two that come to mind are psychic surgery and the French homeopathy researcher Benveniste.
Yeah.
I remember you gave a very, very entertaining lecture about your investigations. It's Jacques Benveniste, right? Is that's his name?
Jacques, yes.
Jacques. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us about that? How did that go?
Well, I was called, I'm trying to think of years again. I've had so many years, I'm not good at recalling years. I was called when I first moved to Florida. I was called by John Maddox, who is now Sir John Maddox, pardon me. Sir John Maddox, who was the editor of Nature magazine at that time. Now, as you probably know, Nature is one of the highest ranking scientific journals, I should say, in the whole world. And he called me and he asked me if I would be interested in going off to Clamart, a little town outside of Paris, to investigate this thing. And I said that I wasn't terribly familiar with it, but I would familiarize myself with it. And so we agreed to go along with Walter Stewart, who at that time was working for the National Institutes of Health in Washington. Walter was rather dedicated to exposing quackery, and he had come upon an awful lot of it in his work with the NIH. So I agreed to do that, but hardly had I hung up the phone before the phone rang again, and lo and behold, there was Benveniste himself, whose English was excellent, very well-educated man. And he said how pleased he was to know that I was coming along to Paris because I would have a possibly alternate point of view. Little did he dream.
Right.
How alternate. And that would be very welcome in the investigation, etc. And he was happy to have me aboard. That, as I suggest to you, rapidly changed after I arrived. And we went over. I was accosted by two leading French scientists in the lobby of the hotel the minute I arrived, who took me aside and told me that I was doing a very, very bad thing here, that I was questioning the integrity and the ability of a leading French scientist. And I said, well, you know, after all, he's making a claim which is not very believable. I'm willing to believe, but we have to see the evidence. We have to see the experiments done. Oh, but this just isn't done, Mr. Randy, and particularly because you're not an academic. No academic would do this, which I suspect is quite true. But they were just astonished that I would dare to do something like this. Now, I don't think they were sent by Benveniste. They were just genuinely alarmed that I was disturbing the French academic world, and indeed I was. So, and to make the story much shorter, we did. We went in. We saw a whole series of tests. They started their tests all over again, did a whole run for us, and we found out quickly that it was not being done in a legitimate manner at all, that they were cutting a lot of corners, that when we double-blind controlled the samples, that is, we took the samples that they had already labeled, and we relabeled every one of them in a closed area, and recorded on video the whole process so it couldn't be doubted that that's what was done. We actually videoed it from the moment that the lab assistant brought the tubes to us and laid them down on the table and kept it in on camera at all times with no interruptions, and had a continuous audio track going in the back. We recorded that way and on paper, and then showed the paper in close-up on the video camera to show that we had recorded exactly what had happened. And we then asked the lab assistant to come back into the lab and pick up the tubes again, which were now relabeled, so that if they knew which ones had been treated and which ones hadn't, they couldn't use any influence on them, except if homeopathy really worked. So we did the test, and no significance was shown whatsoever. And, of course, then they came up with the rationalizations, which went on up until Ben Veniste's death a matter of a few months ago.
Right. I recall you saying that they were scoring the plates, basically counting like the number of bacterial colonies or something in a non-blinded fashion, and they were counting them based upon whether or not it was supposed to have been a response to a homeopathic remedy or not.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, you see, there were some controls. Now, the controls were outside of the whether or not it was treated a set of samples. In other words, you had a basic set of samples there, X number of tubes, about half of which had been treated with the homeopathic compound and half that hadn't, and then you had some blanks. This is what we call the controls. You've got to get the nomenclature clear here. And Elizabeth Davina, the one who was doing the counting under the microscope, one occasion she was sitting at the microscope, and she was counting with a little clicker in her hand, you know, one of these digital clicker. She was going click, 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 click. She stopped, looked at the number, like it was 15 or something, and she recorded 15 on her sheet. And then she took this slide out. Now she was going to put it back. She looked at it, and she put it back in the microscope again. And Walter Stewart, who was standing there, said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Oh, no, that's a control." And she counted again, and she got something like 4 this time.
Oh.
Now, counting these things, you're counting something that doesn't show up very clearly in the microscope slide. You have to make a judgment call on whether or not it's an exploded bacillus or not.
Or just a bubble.
So it's not like an A or B, or it's there or it's not there. It's a decision that you have to make. It's an evaluation. So that showed that since she recognized that was a control, it shouldn't have had any exploded bacillus on it. It should have been just blank.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
so that's
that
basic.
Was an example.
I mean, that's like an extremely basic thing in science, is having objective outcome measures and blinded scoring, so that you can't bias.
It's got to be double blinded, and double blinded, not just single blinded. It's got to be double blinded.
Right.
And by that we mean, I might as well explain to those who don't know. I'm sure you guys do, but double blinded simply means that no one who is involved in the experiment and present at the experiment knows what the results are supposed to be or what the judgment call should be.
Right. And you know, the absence of that really invalidates their entire line of research, which you showed very dramatically. Let me ask you a question. Now, John Maddox asked you to do this. Was there any publication that resulted from your investigation? I mean, was this where was that published?
That was in Nature.
It was published in Nature.
Within a week in Nature, they rushed it to get it in there because they were getting so many questions from all over the world. What were the results? What were the results?
Right.
And they published it in Nature. And then they did a replication, I think something like a year or so after that, an attempted independent replication. And though there were some puzzling results in it, and I've forgotten exactly what those were, certainly the replication showed the same kind of results.
It was basically negative.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Maddox had agreed to publish in Nature at one point a meta-analysis of homeopathy clinical trials. And he did it, he says, after the fact. He published it in Nature in order to spur debate about the topic.
Yes.
But what in fact happened was the scientific community was utterly disinterested in debating the topic, and the homeopathic community just used that as endorsement of homeopathy. And Maddox later said that that was the worst decision he ever made as an editor. Now, chronologically, did he ask you to do this test after that meta-analysis? Do you know this? Is this sort of his way of making up for that error?
That's a good question. Sure? I'm not sure at all. No, I don't really know. I haven't been in touch with John for a couple of years now. Sir John, pardon me.
Yes. It's incredible. I mean, I think it was an example of a, obviously he's a world-renowned, you know, scientist, you know, again, publisher of, again, Nature, which is the most prestigious basic science journal in the world. And he, was so easily, blindsided by the homeopaths, basically because he didn't realize, which is what I perceive in my colleagues and in general in the medical and scientific field, they don't realize that the alternative medicine crowd and, you know, paranormalists in general are not playing by the same rules of fairness that scientists are playing by.
And
it completely blindsided him when
that
happened.
Something else here to be considered. John was surprised that the world of science wasn't terribly interested in what Nature had done. But if he had published something on, as they call him, Father Christmas, or we know him as Santa Claus, and flying reindeer, they would have been equally uninterested, because
right.
they knew from the beginning that this concept of homeopathy is juvenile.
Absolutely.
It's not worthy of consideration, but it is worthy of consideration. And I'll jump to Carl Sagan here. Carl Sagan used to get scolded all the time. People would say to him, and I heard one man say to him at Cornell, Carl, you're an astronomer. You should be doing astronomy. But Carl was much more useful than as a mere astronomer, because he brought all of this crap to the public attention, and he fought the battle valiantly against pseudoscience, as we know. And the same thing happens with scientists who look and they say, who the hell cares about homeopathy? That's nonsense. But the public cares about it, and the public is being victimized by it. And that's, they don't seem to have enough social sense or social responsibility that they should get in there, as they did at one point with astrology, and said, hey, astrology is total nonsense, and objections to astrology is what gave rise to the formation of PSYCOP,
right.
Committee for Scientific Investigation mm-hmm. of Claims of the Paranormal, many, many years ago.
That's right. And, you know, I work within the field of medicine, and I find the exact same thing, that your rank and file academic, scientist, and even just clinical practitioner, they think that the whole body of you know, spiritual medicine and so-called complementary alternative medicine is just nonsense. It's really not worthy of their time and attention. And academics have this sense that it's tainted, that somehow if they deal with it in any way, it's silly, and it sort of is a smudge on their academic reputation, and they really just don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. But as you say, I totally agree with you that what that leads to is the paranormalists having free rein, essentially free rein to defraud the public and to carry on their own agenda. And it's really it's very disconcerting, and there's really a very small number of scientists. The number's greater than zero, fortunately, but it's a very small number of scientists who, like Carl Sagan and like others, see this problem and actively take it on.
Exactly.
But you know, sometimes it's, you know, we feel like a, you know, the voice crying in the wilderness. It's hard to get people to listen to us, you know.
Very true. Very true.
People are either true believers or they don't care.
That's right.
And
Steve.
Yeah,
I think it'd be great to have more scientists talking about that, just like you do. But I'm also afraid, like you touched on earlier, that just because someone's a scientist doesn't mean that they are an expert in other, you know, fields that aren't in their domain, or they're not familiar with, like you said, they're not playing with it by the same rules. So
very true.
I mean, sometimes this might force scientists to actually endorse some of these things because they're hoodwinked like the average Joe citizen as well, because they're just not familiar with the techniques like a magician would be, someone who's familiar with psychology and how people believe in misdirection and sleight of hand. So
that's right, it
could be a double-edged sword.
Well, amazingly, not all scientists are skeptics, or they may think that they are, but they're just not equipped to deal with this world, the world of
and
deception.
And not all of them have the expertise that they need to have. A thing
Absolutely.
About scientists that strikes me very strongly is they saw a paper on it. Well, so-and-so is a PhD, and he published a paper on it. They seem to believe, many of them, not all of them by any means, but many of them tend to believe that if it's written by a legitimate guy with PhD after his name, that it's got to be so. Now, science doesn't prove anything, and I think that's something that shocks a lot of people to hear me say it.
Right.
Science doesn't discover facts. Science discovers statements about the universe around us which appear to make a valid statement about how the universe works. But that statement is subject to correction either now or at any time in the future, subject to better or different evidence. It's subject to total cancellation or adjustment or validation. It's subject to all of these things. It's a tentative statement that appears to be correct.
Right. Yeah, the goal is to get closer and closer to the truth, knowing that you will never actually reach it.
No, of course not. You can't get anywhere near it. I often say to my audiences that one drop of any selected water from anywhere you want to name could occupy a crowd of scientists for the rest of their professional lives, and they wouldn't be able to say, now we know everything about that drop of water.
That's right. There's always deeper levels of knowledge and reality, and also everything is tentative, as you say. But I think there's another huge misconception that keeps cropping up is the difference between the authority of an individual scientist or an individual institution or an individual paper or study versus an evolving consensus of the scientific community. And I think what you're saying, well, somebody reads a paper or a scientist has a certain belief or claim and they think that they attach some sort of authority to that, but in reality that's meaningless because there are papers and scientists all over the map in terms of claims and beliefs and evidence. The only thing that really has any reliability, in my opinion, is a mature, established consensus of opinion that's built upon multiple independently replicated studies. But the media, for sure, doesn't perceive the difference between those two things. They quote,
or they choose not to.
It's lazy and easy for them not to. So they just choose to cite expert scientist X who makes this fantastic claim, and that's a good enough authority for them. And they're not apparently bothered by the fact that what scientist X has to say is contrary to a deeply well-established scientific consensus. So just one of the many hurdles that I think that we deal with in this arena of skepticism.
Right.
I to change the topic slightly, I was wondering, Rennie, in all your many years of testing, have you ever, after someone failed one of your tests, and they've all been failures, have you ever had somebody say, well, I guess you're absolutely right. I have no such ability. I'll stop making such claims. And have you ever had anybody react anything like that?
Oh, yes, certainly. It's never lasted. It happened, for example, when we were doing dowsing tests with multimillionaire Dick Smith in Australia many years ago. We did very comprehensive tests of these dowsers. We had 11 of them. And he got them all into his office, and they're all in a group there, and he had to ask them the question. Now, we had the cameras rolling at the time, and he had to ask them the question. He said, I'd like to see my show of hands. I'm trying to do my Australian accent here. I'd like to see my show of hands. How many of you might have changed your mind now about your dowsing abilities? And no hands went up. And then one gentleman made a tentative motion with his right hand, and finally did raise his hand. And Dick, of course, jumped on him right away and said, you've changed your mind? And he said, I really have to think about it twice now. He said, I've never had an experience like this, and I have to seriously doubt whether or not my belief in this is really sound. And Dick turned to me with a big smile on his face, and the gentleman left shortly after that. They all disbanded, and we went on talking with the reporters who were there. And Dick was absolutely giggling with glee. He carried on. He said, we've never had anyone reverse themselves. And I said, Dick, give him a couple of weeks, and he'll think of some excuse. Well, I was wrong on that. It only took him 20 minutes because he called in. He stopped at a public phone on his way out of the place where we were at that moment and called in, and he said that he'd been thinking it over, and it was the walkie-talkies we were using at the time. This was many, many moons ago. And he said,
walkie who now?
Walkie talkies. that we were using because they put out an RF emanation, you see.
Right.
Okay. And he figured that's why he was wrong. Now, subsequently, he was tested in Perth, Australia, the other coast of Australia, by Dick Smith and another group, and he went right off the charts in negative results. He, as a matter of fact, it was almost Psy missing, if you know what that is.
Yeah, right. Worse than random. Right.
Yes.
So before we forget, let's not forget to plug the Amazing Meeting 4. This is the fourth annual Amazing Meeting, which is run by the JREF, and it's coming up at the end of this month, January 26th to 29th, and this is going to take place in Las Vegas. So who do you have lined up for this conference?
Oh, my goodness, don't start me. Murray Gell-Mann. Murray Gell-Mann and Nadine Strossen and all kinds of very, very interesting people. The subject this year is science and politics and the politics of science.
Mm-hmm.
By that, we mean how well science does in politics, and it's not doing very well because of the Bush administration, of course,
right,
which is
right.
Science bashing left and right.
Oh, yeah.
And the politics in science is how people in science are subject to political pressures and how they, as academics, have to fight their way around and try to evade certain restrictions that are put on them by the politicians out there. They have to continue to get funding, and yet they can't say poo-poo words of any kind, or they're in big trouble. So it's going to be very, very captivating. And, of course, we've got Penn and Teller, and, of course, Richard Wiseman, and we've got Phil Plait, of course, the bad astronomer. He's a fixture.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got, I mentioned Penn and Teller. Yes, we've also got the Mythbusters coming out. And
that show's great.
Not only great show, but they're great guys, too. They really are fun.
I've watched a bunch of episodes. I love the show. The guys look like a lot of fun. One thing, though, I wish that they would cover more paranormal topics. I know it's difficult because you have to actually build stuff that explodes to make it interesting, but I wish they would tackle some more paranormal topics on their show. They haven't hit many of them.
Well, you know, Penn and Teller are doing a pretty damn good job of that.
They are. They are.
Yes.
The bullshit series.
Oh, absolutely.
Certainly. We've got some heavy people out there batting for us, you know?
Oh, I know. I just love to see them tackle.
It's not really their shtick, though. I mean, they deal more with urban legends than with hardcore paranormal stuff.
You have to understand that. But I must say, the registration, we just got more registrants today even. It's going to go right up to the wire, I'm sure. But it's going to have to cut off very soon now. I don't think we could take more than another 20 or 25, perhaps, because the big auditorium there will only handle 710, so we've got to be well short of that.
So that's your what are you capping it at then?
Probably at 690, because there'll always be media people that have to be accommodated.
Right. So next year you're going to get a bigger place.
It looks like we're going to have to, because this is beyond our expectations altogether.
Are you going to keep it on the West Coast? Are you ever thinking of moving it to the East Coast?
Well, we're even thinking of moving it internationally, Steve. We're contemplating the idea of doing one in the UK. That may mean doing two a year, but it's a very good fundraiser for us, so that wouldn't be out of the question at all. We've been promised all kinds of good things if we were to take it to England, because that makes all of Europe, they have pretty good access to England, and rather easily and rather cheaply. So it makes it very attractive to them, but we're just testing that market now.
I see. So you make money at these conferences?
Oh yes, no, we do very well.
That's great.
It's about half of our entire budget.
Wow,
that's interesting, because PsyCop is always complaining that skeptical meetings lose money, but that I guess that's just the way that they hold them. But
well, maybe of course we have the auctions and we have the celebrity dinner. Jamie Ian Swiss, by the way. Well, of course I failed to mention him. Jamie Ian Swiss is going to be there again.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but I don't know how many. I think we've got like four or maybe even five sessions with him that are sold out to the roof.
Wow.
We actually expanded his audience somewhat. That has made the permissible audiences. I think he only wants something like 30 people at a time.
Yeah.
And we had to expand that somewhat because his tickets sold almost instantly.
Just out of curiosity, do you know, remember offhand, is Chris Mooney slated to speak? He wrote the book, The Republican War on Science. It seems right up the alley.
I think we went after Chris, but he wasn't able to help us this year, perhaps next year.
Yeah, he's a busy guy.
There's always a number of Mr. Harris, what's his first name? The guy who wrote, An End to Faith, is it? Yeah, The End of Faith. What's his first name? It's Harris. Not Sam Harris. In any case, he will probably be helping us out
Sam
next
Harris.
Year.
Sam Harris?
Yeah, I believe it's Sam Harris.
Sam
yeah.
Harris. Okay. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great meeting. If anyone listening to this in time, you might want to pay a visit to randy.org and sign up, get one of those last spots. Unfortunately, we will not be able to make it this year. I definitely hope to make a future meeting. And definitely, if you have it on the East Coast, we'll make it. So are you working on any books at the moment?
Am I working on any books? Dolly Parton sleep on her back? Let's get real here. I've got two of them in the works, and one of them is called A Magician in the Laboratory. Mm-hmm. I won't have any problems getting publishers, I think, for that.
No.
Nor for another one, which is simply called Wrong with an exclamation point.
I like that.
To the point. Yeah. I assume that the Magician in the Laboratory is about your investigations of, you know, more scientific studies. There are scientists that were bamboozled by paranormalists.
Yes, and it will deal very in-depth with the Benveniste event, as a matter of fact. Benveniste died last year very, very tragically on the operating table and brain surgery, as a matter of fact. Mm. And so I'm a little freer to say things that I might not have said before.
Right, right. Right, the dead can't sue.
Yeah, exactly.
And in Europe, the just as an aside, the libel laws are very, yeah, much more liberal. The threshold is a lot lower than in the United States.
Well, particularly in the UK. In the UK,
yeah,
they're really medieval, because you can literally sue someone for wearing a tie that offends you. Now, that doesn't mean you can win, and
right,
it doesn't
right.
mean that the justice is actually going to allow it to take place. He's going to accept it. But it does mean that legally you can do such a thing. And people sue people for saying something that offends them, in a public speech even.
Mm-hmm.
It's an astonishing set of laws, and it means you have to retain a lawyer, of course, and you have to go through all this expense.
So it's easy to file harassment suits.
Oh, yes, of all kinds. Any kind of anything that has a libel suit in the UK, you can sue people for anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's bad enough in the U.S., but the U.S. has a more of a reasonable threshold for
yes, indeed,
for proof.
And you should know that Uri Geller has a very hard time bringing civil cases in this country now.
Just because lawyers are unwilling to take his cases because of his track record?
Well, that's one reason, I'm sure. But the other reason is that he was declared by the Supreme Court as being a litigious individual. Mm-hmm. And that's all that a judge needs to know, mm-hmm, when he's deciding whether or not he's going to accept a case from someone.
Oh, good.
So that's the mark of death, the kiss of death.
Yeah, and we make sure that judges know about that.
That's good.
Right.
That's good to know. That's definitely good. So we could feel more free to trash Uri Geller on our show. Is that what you're saying?
No, I didn't say the libel.
I didn't use the L word. I didn't use the L word.
To discuss him in a serious manner, let's put it that way.
In a scientific and cold manner.
Yes.
I notice on your Swift Online, an excellent weekly online newsletter, by the way, a must read for all skeptics. For anyone intelligent, actually, the banner is very interesting. Again, this is a psychic fiasco. You have the case of Robert Vanderbroek, who is a Dutch alleged psychic who was giving a reading on a television show, I guess, and
he did it too well.
He did it a little bit too well. He was spontaneously giving a reading of the wife of a cameraman and saying that she had a past life.
No. Well, yes, that's right. I'm sorry.
Right.
Go ahead.
And gave details of the previous life, which were remarkably detailed. And it turns out that the details could be found on a website with a simple Google search, including he reproduced a typo in his reading, which clearly brands his reading as plagiarism.
That he got directly from Google, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So it's hard to argue with facts like that.
Well, there's another thing coming up which I won't reveal now. It's not going to be on next week's page, folks, so stay tuned.
Okay.
About Robert with the two Bs. Robert apparently pulled some other fancy stuff on them and that's going to be revealed next week.
Now, but you make the point in your newsletter that you know, this is as clear as day. I think anyone with a brain can see that this guy was just dredging information from the internet and regurgitating it as if he were reading, and he was caught red-handed because he reproduced a typo. But he's not going anywhere. I mean, this is not the end of his career, because these you know, pseudo-psychics survive these kinds of gaffes. Sylvia Brown will survive her gaffe on Coast to Coast.
Oh, yes, of course.
Because the will to believe is just too strong, even for
well,
such...
It's not only the will to believe, it's the need to believe,
yes.
David. The
yes.
need. It's, I used to say that people want these things to be true. No, they need them to be true, because it fulfills their fantasies, it gives them a picture of the universe, which is much more acceptable than reality, and they need it to be true. They need it desperately.
And that is an issue that we confront often, because you know, frequently we find ourselves... confronted with people who are just not dealing on a rational level. So we could make all of the scientific, rational, logical, evidence-based arguments that we want, but the fact is they believe for reasons entirely other than reason and evidence.
Very
so
true.
How do we get through to these people, though? I mean, what is there? Do we just say, okay, they're impenetrable to logic and evidence, so we don't worry about
right.
them?
Yes,
or is,
we do.
Is, that's, that certainly is the default, because I don't know of anyone who's really come up with a good alternative. Is there any way to get them to, at least in some cases, to perhaps fulfill their needs in more... you know, rational or reasonable ways?
It happens occasionally. We always try to do that, but it happens occasionally. I've had people call by here with a tattered copy of Flim Flam and say that they went through it in detail, trying to pick holes in my argument, and finally decided, gee, maybe the man's right, and they came by to sort of apologize.
Mm-hmm.
All they get for that is a hearty handshake and another copy of Flim Flam, but
right.
nonetheless, it does happen every now and then. By and large, The convinced believer will never be unconvinced, because they just can't believe that they fell for something like that. No, I wouldn't fall for something like
right.
that. I'm not a fool. It doesn't mean they're a fool. It means they may be naive. It may also mean that maybe they're not educated as they might be or they need to be in these cases. It doesn't mean that they're fools, however.
Right, but there's huge cognitive dissonance when people
yes.
are confronted with the evidence, basically, that they have been led to believe something that is utterly false and perhaps even foolish. And there's, you know, there's psychological literature which shows that, for example, like in cults where a specific dated claim was made, the UFO is going to take us away next Tuesday,
yeah.
and next Tuesday comes and goes. And, you know, to any thinking person, the claims were disproven. Following those kinds of revelations that should wake people up, people believe even deeper and will typically go on recruiting drives following those kinds of episodes.
Yeah, no, there's an excellent book out on that subject, by the way.
Yeah.
When Prophecy Fails. I don't recall yeah. the names of the co-authors. They're sociologists. But it's beautiful
right.
because the end of the world was coming for these people. They were absolutely convinced of it. They had given away their property. They were in the white robes and the sandals on the mountain. The whole the picture that you dread happening again, but it will happen again, and it's happening right now, I'm sure, someplace in the world. But then their rationalization after it all failed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just astonishing. It's hard to believe.
Yeah.
I often quote a woman who stood up in an audience after I had a question and an answer period following one of my lectures, and she stood up, and it was about the last question that was going to be asked, and she said, "Mr. Randy, if you'll pardon me, I think I've solved what your problem is." And there was a titter of laughter around the audience, and I smiled, and I said, "Well, pray tell, what is it?" She said, "I believe that you're over-obsessed with reality."
Over-obsessed with
and
reality.
And the audience started to laugh and clap, and she thought that was approbation. She thought that was... That they were accepting her.
Right.
This was for her. And she turned around and held up her hands and smiled at the audience and sat down looking very smug. And I just paused for a minute and I said, You may be right.
You may be right.
She clapped her hands, and she told me afterwards, she came to the foot of the stage, and she said, well, I'm glad I got through to you. I didn't make much comment on it. But
yeah, yeah.
This woman is probably still thinking she's the one who got through to me.
Right. Now, Steve Pinker has something very interesting to say about the whole rationalization thing. He's a psychologist at Harvard who wrote...
Who we're hoping to get for next year, by the way.
Yeah, he's excellent. I'd love to have him on the Skeptics Guide. But he, in his book, The Blank Slate, he writes about a lot of the neurology and psychology literature, which shows that most of the time what people do on a day-to-day basis is they believe things for essentially subconscious, emotional, hardwiring reasons. And then most of our conscious thought is spent not deciding what to believe, but rationalizing what we already do believe. That's actually how most people operate most of the time. We just believe things for subconscious reasons, and then most of our cortex is spent just rationalizing those emotionally held beliefs. And I think what we do as skeptics often is just really rawly show that process in action.
Mm-hmm. But Stephen is brilliant.
Yeah, he is. But it's very very sobering to think about the idea that that's basically just human nature. That's how our brains work.
Yep.
Is to
that's the way it goes.
And I do see. You know, what we do is skepticism in general, just, you know, science and reason as really the best way to transcend, you know, the limitations of human nature. You know, maybe that is the way we are hardwired to be, but certainly we can overcome it, you know, just through the application of reason. And that, I think if there's a one sort of synthesis of our message, I think that that's it.
Randy, Were you heartened by the recent intelligent design decision out of Dover?
Oh, yes, but we know that it's going to rise again. Of course, yeah. It's one of those unsinkable rubber ducks as well. It hasn't gone away permanently, not by any means. I was heartened by it. Of course, Pat Robertson told us that Dover better not appeal to God because they've turned against him. And God is a little, he's sort of touchy on things like that from what I understand. But I was heartened by it, that's not the end of the battle, not by any means.
No, but that judge's ruling was pretty scathing, I think.
Oh, it was.
It was good, yeah.
Not only that, he was a staunch Republican and,
yes.
And a church-going Christian, the whole thing, which shows that people who are in a position like that have to do what they were elected to do. And he did it. And my hat's off to him. Kudos.
Here.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
It's true. These belief systems never go away, but we can have a victory in that they could be marginalized, and their impact and influence can be greatly marginalized. The good thing about this is that this is now a legal precedent, and even though we'll never be able to get rid of creationism because it's, you know, again, it's a religious belief, it's not a scientific belief, its ability to, you know, influence public school education can certainly be taken away with these legal victories. So I think it's very meaningful, these kind of victories. So James Randi, again, the James Randi Education Foundation, you can visit his website at randi.org. Randi, thank you once again for being on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
And I must say, people will be tuning in sometime. I guess it'll go up on February 10th, according to my calendar here. We will have our own podcast starting at that time of the year. And we hope that people will be clicking in on us, too.
Absolutely. Again, it was a pleasure. We appreciate it. Hope to have you on again sometime in the future.
Certainly.
Thank you, Randi.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randi.
Good luck at the amazing meeting, and hopefully we'll catch you at one of those in the future.
As Mae West once said, luck has nothing... No, she said goodness has nothing to do with it, but luck has nothing to do with it, Steve.
Okay.
You're
right.
It's hard work, believe me.
Take care. So that was great to have James Randi on the Skeptic's Guide. I hope, again, we have him on again sometime soon. He is, of course, probably the biggest celebrity in skepticism, if there is one.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well,
very, very entertaining, very fun to talk to. He has a million stories.
He gets it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Randi gets it.
Well, the hour went by very quickly, as it always does, especially when we have such interesting guests on our show. But the hour is up, so Bob, Evan, Perry, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you,
Doctor.
Our
pleasure. See you next week.
Next week, everyone.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information about this and other episodes, visit our website at www.thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kenno and is used with permission.
That's last theorem. Let him far from the mainstream. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems, proofs, endless delays.